This is Glenn Zuckman, 30,000 feet over Pennsylvania. My co-hosts Amy Knowles, Martin Herman, and I are on Continental Airlines Flight 16 from Los Angeles to New York City, where we'll be interviewing Joshua Freed.
You know, you just came off this interview with Eric Singer in LA, who was in LA, who has collaborated with Joshua Freed on one of his interface devices, the wheel. Apparently he did the programming which allows Joshua to control certain processes that are happening on the computer. And also Joshua's composed for the robots that Eric created, the guitar body. So that's an interesting connection. I'm looking forward to following up on that.
Yeah, there is an awful lot of collaboration going on with the New York composers, and I'd like to find out a little bit more about that process.
Clear skies and a temperature of 30 degrees. Once again, thanks a whole bunch for flying with us today. You know, we really do appreciate business. We do hope you enjoyed the flight, and we do hope to see you in the future.
Well, we're really feeling the steep descent now, so I think we're not too far out of New York. So for myself, my co-hosts Amy Knowles and Martin Herman, this is Glenn Zuckman on Continental Airlines Flight 16 to New York, signing off. You're listening to Border Patrol from the Classical Music Initiative, a service of American Public Media. We're exploring musical mappings this week with Lemur founder Eric Singer and Radio Wonderland's Joshua Freed. Martin, what was your introduction to Joshua Freed's work?
I first met Joshua in 1993 in Minneapolis. He was giving a performance there of a piece called Travelogue. And it's a piece for one performer and headset. And what happens in that piece is that the performer has not heard what's coming through the headset before. And their job is to, with absolutely no lag time, is to duplicate exactly what they're hearing on the headset live. So there's that element going on. Then there's also a live pre-recorded tape part that accompanies the singer, although the singer or the actor, whoever's doing it, doesn't know what that sound is either. So as a result of that, the sounds that are made are extraordinary. It's very hard to describe. It's not like a music that I'd ever heard before. And all of us in the audience were just completely at the edge of our seat for the entire performance. It was fun. It was engaging. Because obviously there was a lot of time that Joshua spent thinking about what the performer was hearing through the headset. I mean, that was not random. It wasn't improvised in any way. It was all pre-recorded, pre-timed, very controlled. But the effect of it was a kind of Fellini-esque, crazy mix of sound and just a riot of sound, but not sounding chaotic, purposeful, and very troubling too. I mean, it was just magnificent use of that whole idea of headset-driven performance.
Raiders, police, people, and railings are doing the way. Drake, Sebastian. And it's so alive. Nobody knows, and I know I don't name it. I don't less of it. Is anybody to turn around him?
If everybody had an hour, but as a USA, internet it would surfing, and when I ain't, and I remember, things are not true.
So that's how I know Joshua, through that particular piece, and I've followed his career since then with great interest.
Well, why don't we transport ourselves to his New York City living room and listen to a little bit of Radio Wonderland performed live by Joshua Freed. Peace.
Okay, that's enough for now. Thank you.
Amazing. Now, there's a lot going on here that obviously our audience can't see. Could you talk us through the main components of this system?
We started with me grabbing loops off of the radio, and then a loop that I took from the radio, I pitch shifted a little bit. I edited the start point and end point.
And you did that on this device?
I did it
device,
on this
which is called?
Well, it's called a motor mix, and it's a fader box, and it looks like a mixer and can function as a mixer, but is really only a controller, which means that it's sending data to the actual audio unit, which for this piece is the computer. And in this piece, all the processing is done entirely in the computer, all of it, although I touch the computer hardly at all. I am hitting shoes with sticks, fiddling with knobs and sliders and buttons, hitting pedals, and moving the steering wheel. And yet it's all being done inside the laptop. And I just, I like it that way. I don't like the image, and I don't like being the one who is huddled behind the laptop, you know, where you could just see the top of their head and the
one of the aspects,
glow.
In addition to other things you're doing, is to get away from that sort of geek over
propeller
a laptop model that's producing interesting sounds but not interesting visual experience.
Yeah. And it's not just sort of a secondary goal. The idea that I want to make the performance clear to people, the processing clear to people in the performance, is really a compositional guideline for me. And I am wanting so much to take the audience with me as I do the processing to make it clear to them that it controls the structure of the piece. One doesn't necessarily have that as the only way or the best way to make good music, but it is a perfectly valid guiding principle for composition, and it totally informs.
Well, I think as physical, tactile people, we like that sort of one-to-onefulness of action and sonic result rather than...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I prefer the sticks and the wheel to the body suits and the gloves and the infrared beams and stuff that we have. I love some of the people that do that, but it's not my bag. And if you look closely at what the shoes and the wheel are doing, they are really almost a spoof on these highly sophisticated, wonderful gadgets, because they're really super simple, especially the wheel. It's just a big knob. That's all it is, but I like it that way. Mm-hmm. And if I can make good music with it, its simplicity is just so much the better. It makes me feel better about the music. I think it communicates better. And likewise, the shoes, they're really just electronic drum pads.
You eliminated all of the vowel sounds and you left us with
the re-esser.
That's what it was called. Yeah.
Yes. Let me go back to that. I worked very hard this fall programming what I call the re-esser. It is the opposite of a piece of studio gear that's known as a de-esser. And a de-esser is something that audio engineer, record producer in radio or in pop production would probably know. The de-esser is a device that eliminates extra sibilances, which are especially troublesome for a needle on a vinyl record. I don't know if the de-esser is as in demand as it was. Hmm. So what I wanted to do was extract the S's and T's and then program them like a drum machine. And programming it was very difficult, but so rewarding. And so here's the re-esser. I can take the loop. And then I created a situation for myself in which I can take those S's and T's and on the fly program them like a drum machine. And so... And the wheel in this situation changes the pitch. One of the reasons I programmed this the way I did was because it's important to me to be able to go back to the source to remind the audience of where this collage came from. And that's a big musical decision for me to make just for essentially narrative purposes. But I don't care. And I mentioned this to my father, and he said, oh, it's sort of like a theme and variations. I was like, by golly, you're right. And I like that. And I came by it innocently, you know? One element that we haven't gone over at all, the anything bass. The idea, if it isn't apparent, is for me to take live radio, live commercial radio, the mainstream, standard, recognizable commercial stream, chop it up as I like and turn it into funky musical patterns that are enjoyable, even danceable. And in a way, it's like John Cage, but in a way, it's totally the opposite. In a way, it's total musical conservatism. Because whereas Cage said, open your ears. Mm-hmm. Open your ears so wide that the whole wild universe of sound is heard as music. In a way, I'm doing something much more conservative. I'm saying, I'll take any sound in the universe, in the wild universe of all sound, well, of all radio, and tame it and narrow it down to match the width of our ears as they are now. And I don't mean to be a conservative anti-Cage person, but I think it's just sort of an angle to sort of grasp this. And it is definitely my angle that I'm trying to make very simple musical transformations of my source and have it be funky, which is not to mean smells bad or isn't put together well, but as in James Brown, funky.
Got it.
But I forgot. Oh, the anything bass. Yeah. Okay. So I have the radio. So I grab a loop, and I'm going to take the whole 4 seconds here for a second. Same loop, just really, really short, and I can hear different parts of it. So short that it, in fact, has become a pitch. Right? Right? Take different parts of it. Just different sections of the same loop.
A microsecond of the sound.
Yes. Yes. Through. It's actually, I believe, it is actually 16.198158 milliseconds, which, as we all know, is B. It's the note B. So I created a riff based on B, and I don't know if it's going to work.
Points as well,
it's just duration, just pitch. So, okay, guided tour.
Yeah.
I think we did
so,
it.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah,
good.
Really.
Oh,
amazing.
My
work.
Pleasure.
You're listening to Border Patrol from American Public Media. This is Glenn Zuckman and Martin Herman in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, at the home of composer Joshua Fried. Joshua, speaking of tape, you know, we've had sound for all of human history, singing, wailing, breathing, sex. But recorded sound we've only had for a flicker of time.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
what do you think of this reproducing ourselves adventure that we've been on for
a little while? We've been doing it since about the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that we've been understanding it only maybe in about the last 20 years. This idea of mechanical reproduction is so profound. There was the guy, Benjamin? Who wrote Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. The profundity of this mechanical reproduction, I think, is huge and has taken a long time to absorb. And as we've been absorbing it, the technology has been leaping forward so we can do so many more things that we then have to absorb.
But I mean, aren't we in an era of never fully absorbing? Because by the time you absorb,
we're
already beyond.
I think we are now. And I think there is a danger in the faddishness of new technologies and the way they can dominate a discipline or a medium for a period of time. The new drum machine comes out, everyone uses it. The sampler comes out, everyone uses it, when they still haven't explored what a tape loop can do. Just because it's old technology doesn't mean that we have finished exploring. I think Bob Dylan was one of the geniuses of electronic music because he understood that it was more profound to make a crazy utterance that couldn't even be repeated. It was so twisted. And repeat that mechanically, which is a far more insightful use of mechanical reproduction than having a synthesizer playing a bleep and then reproducing that mechanically, which is just mechanical reproduction upon mechanical reproduction.
Well, you know, out of all that technology, actually, I heard there's a statistic that I love now. It's been estimated that the total digital output of the planet Earth is 2,000 gigabits per second.
Uh-huh.
And I just sort of find myself wondering, does a planet that's busy producing 2,000 gigabits per second of product have time for 4 minutes and 33 seconds of John Cage?
Well, we better make that time. And that 4 minutes and 33 seconds is filled with information, and that isn't going to change. I don't know, how many gigabits per second?
2,000.
2,000 gigabits is discarded. But the fact that it's there really does color our experience. Oh, this is very interesting. There is a growing body of speculation that biology can be reduced to the information sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And information is dealt with in terms of entropy. So are we really doing something with the laws of thermodynamics, with the digital revolution? I don't know. I don't know the answer. It is very interesting. And I'm somewhere, Radio Wonderland is kind of in that mix, conceptually, I guess. I certainly am interrupting some of those gigabits and turning them around, but...
And creating perhaps a few more gigabits.
Yeah.
Well, I had a question about your musical shoes.
Yes.
Why did you choose shoes as surfaces to hit rather than practice pads or something else? What was it about shoes?
There's two answers. One is the true story of how I sort of stumbled into it. I get it. And the other one is sort of the rationalization, like why I think shoes are good and why I'm sticking with them. I'll start with the second one. They are the opposite of the chrome-plated drum pads that you can buy in the music store. These shoes especially are not particularly fashionable looking. They are very lowly, ordinary objects, and they are disconnected from the sound that they make. And I think that's important because if I were to buy the electronic music tool, people get the idea that there's something essential about the look and form of that tool that creates the sound. But it's not. It is completely arbitrary. It's just a thing that I'm hitting. That said, it would probably be more effective for me to have a shoe, a book, an iron, and a glove or something. But I haven't done that. It's just shoes. And I guess I can just say it's sort of instinctive. Or tell you the real story, which is that, you know, the shoes are opening gates. They're not necessarily triggering samples. And a gate, for those of you who just tuned in, it's like a robot hand on a volume control. There's an aural scene, an audio scene that's transpiring behind the gate. And when I hit the shoe, it opens the gate for just a tiny moment. And then the gate shuts again. And while the gate is open, you hear a little bit of the audio unaltered as long as the gate is open. And then it shuts again. So the shoes are triggering gates. I have been working with gates for many years, predating the shoes. I would hit a microphone, tap it, and this other sound would come out, a tape loop of my own voice. And it was this fun performative gag and a way for me to generate music that was more visual and allowed me to be percussive instead of dialing in a tape loop.
Well, Joshua Fried, thanks for patrolling the borders of new music with us today.
Oh, well, my pleasure. It's
and
been
before
fun.
We leave, I think maybe we need a little more Radio Wonderland.
Oh, I'm happy
could
to.
You, well, do we need to reset first? Or
maybe I can kind of continue from where I was. It would be a good exercise. Just a second. Let me crank this.
KM at WCBSFM.com. That's MMCCA. WCBSFM.com. The music of the king every Sunday night. Elvis.
Thanks for patrolling the borders of new music with us. Max Leffer, Annie Chelsea, Bijal Shah, and Nicole Nelson provided production assistance for this broadcast. Scott Younganeil and Jen Munson engineered it. Mary Lee and Lauren D provided invaluable assistance. Border Patrol comes to you from the Classical Music Initiative. It's funded in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support is provided by Mr. and Mrs. Howard Solomon. I'm Glenn Zuckman. For Martin Herman, Amy Knowles, myself, and all the artists crossing the borders of new music, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
American Public Media.